Well, we've survived the rain. Maybe it washed away some everybody. It's who knows. I've never been in so much rain in my entire life. It's unbelievable. In the Santa Cruz Mountains, it came down. It was heavy. It just crashed into the house, just beating on it. It was really wonderful. I mean, it's the power of nature just showing us who's who. Think you're so great, take this. And it just kept coming and coming and coming. It's what, 3 days? Friday. It was snowing when we left Chicoji on Friday. Big flakes coming down. Huh?
It was snowing at
Chicoji. Yeah, all during the lunch at the end of Sashin. We'd look out the window and it would be falling down. Very cool. Except we were all hoping to get home. Just slither up the road. Yeah, remarkable. It's a good Sashin. Ellie was there. Ritu was there for a second. Jules was there for 5 minutes. I'm teasing. The weekend was very crowded. There were lots and lots of people there. And then it boiled down to 10 people.
Oh,
and it was just right. Just perfect.
I remember Sunday night, it was raining.
Yes.
It
was
hot.
Yes.
It's like flash floods.
Ah. A deluge. Just no room for a human being in all that water. So what happened last week?
You just talked about Zazen and the benefits of it.
I know you can't talk about that.
Yeah.
How you what?
And how you can't really talk about that.
Oh, exactly. It's hopeless.
Julian did a great job, though.
Thank you. Thank you for doing that. I think everybody should have a turn giving a talk like that. I think that's really good practice. A friend of mine who teaches Korean Zen does that. He says every one of his students is made to give a talk, whether they want to or not. I think it's a really good idea. Terrifying idea, I know, but it's bracing. That's when you really begin to realize how little you know. And when you really start to learn something, it's wonderful. So we are on page 44, I do believe. Yes, I'm sure it is, number 17.
In an evening talk, he said, students should think of the fact that they will surely die. This truth is indisputable, but even if you do not think about that fact, you should, for the time being, determine not to pass the time in vain. You should not spend time in vain by doing useless things, but by doing things which are worthwhile, should you pass the time.
Among those things which are to be done today, which of all things is most important? Know that everything outside of the actions of Buddha and patriarchs is all useless.
It's an odd thing, isn't it? Where does that leave us? Who are those Buddhas and patriarchs anyway? The Sandokai has the same message at the very end of it, the poem. It says, do not waste time. I don't think it's the Protestant ethic kind of thing where you're trying to make the most out of everything and get the most out of everything. It's more understanding what this is right now. It isn't a dream. It isn't our made-up idea about what this is. It's right this. It's a very good question. It's a koan for us to know which of all things is the most important. And I don't see how we can sit down and figure it all out either. We can make a list and prioritize, but I don't think that's what this means either. Means what in our heart is the most important thing, moment by moment by moment. Which means stopping very often and just being present with what's happening, with what we're doing. That is the Buddha patriarch, ancestor. That is the mind of Buddha. The present moment mind. So it's not so hard. It's what Thich Nhat Hanh is always doing, always stopping and ringing a bell, and suddenly the mind clears, and you're just there. The telephone rings, and if you don't answer the telephone right away, you create a whole new mind in your mind. And when you do answer the telephone, it's with a Buddha mind, being willing to meet the Buddha on the other end. Otherwise, it's just like we're...
Except for the telemarketer, he's blowing off.
That's a Buddha too.
No.
Yes, it is. They are obnoxious, I must say. They're pretty bad. So loud.
I'm not changing the topic, really. So I'm reading this book, and it's about what the guy is calling, he made up a word called neuroeconomics. So they're studying the stuff that's at the intersection between like neurology, like almost in a physical sense, what's in your brain, and economic decisions, like investment decisions or
financial
choices.
Wow.
But actually the book is full of examples from, personal decisions, love life decisions, and all amazingly a wide array. And what's really fascinating about it is he frequently points out that your brain reacts to this kind of financial decision, which is why the person is reading the book, the same way as you react to some other, quote, regular activity. The fear of financial loss is the fear of losing your loved one. Your brain reacts the same way. And he often draws these parallels and, you know, which part of the brain is firing, and they have these methods now to look. One of the fascinating things he talked about at one point was how what you think about just before you make a decision affects your approach to that decision. So if you think about something positive right before making a financial decision, you're likely to make a more positive choice. And if you think about something negative right before, and it even doesn't matter what that is, and you make the and you make a choice, you'll look at a glass half empty.
Yes.
Now, what's fascinating, I think, about this, how this might relate, and this is how I interpreted the book in the practice sense, is our practice is to see the telemarketer for who he is. He's doing his job whether or not we like to get the phone call or not. And instead of thinking about a good thing or a bad thing before we lift the receiver, we think about what the Heart Sutra calls emptiness. We put ourselves in neutral, like an open state, and answer the phone.
Yeah.
And that, of course, he doesn't talk about that. I'm extending what he's saying, but he's talking about it from the point of view of putting a spin on it, and your brain is built that way. And I think our practice is to put no spin at all, and to open yourself moment by moment and let that a little space happen right before you pick up the phone and see that you can be open. Is that a kind of a valid interpretation of our practice in the midst of this, the context of this book?
I'm not sure how the book fits in exactly, but it certainly is how we do. That if we assume that we know the telemarketer, which we often do, we assume and we don't like, then we're a little bit living in an unreal world. It's a delusion. And if we assume that we don't know and allow ourselves to be open to finding out who that is, then it doesn't mean that we adore the telemarketer when we find out. It's just that we handle the whole situation differently. And that is the point, really. Because compassion can't happen until we actually are connected directly, viscerally, with who we're with, what we're with, anything. That's how it works. I think a lot of that brain research is going to be very helpful to everybody.
It is so amazing when you describe some of these experiments that have
been
done. They sound so simple, but you know they concoct very simplistic decisions, but then they watch the different parts of your brain that are activated and not activated, and then the more complicated cases are where they're communicating. And how some people who have brain problems, like brain injuries, can't, for example, see something at all. They're incapable of it anymore, unfortunately.
Yes.
And yet, the consequence of that can be very dire. People don't remember, for example, a pain in their past, and they'll do something painful because they can't remember the lesson. Right? You know, it isn't that we live our life without memory. Right? I mean, there is a memory, and there's a utility to that. And we've evolved because of that, still have that. And we may overreact at times, but there's a reason for it.
Yeah.
And to now, you know, reading this book, I think it connects for me incredibly to practice, because it's, at every point when he says one of these things, it's like, you can't, if the research says it's lighting up that way, you can't deny it. You know, it's kind of like really there. And what does that fear that you get from these two situations mean as a common, because something is firing in common? That's fascinating to me. I see a lot of practice opportunity around that.
Well, there's so many theories about love and economics. Money and love are two very tightly connected subjects anyway. And we think we know. We have all these ideas about those things. And I've always thought that especially the ideas about economics were just hogwash, because they were all made up. You know, people wrote books about it, but they didn't really know what made people do what they do. Because it's very emotional and unconscious activity, the way, and love is the same. Most of it is unconscious and very emotional. And then we try to, you know, make this little package and say, well, this is how it works. But we don't know how it works.
It seems to me like in areas like that where you're making, and it tells more about the mind of the economicist than anything real. To me, what is challenging is like the it's so hard to get well. Like the notion of sometimes like being stuck and you're not even I feel like I don't even know how set in my ways I am.
Yes. Yes.
And I like to think I'm a pretty flexible dude, but like I mean, it's weird, and like and some of it is due because not awareness. Like, I mean.
Absolutely. Which is a practice.
Like sitting, yeah, well, like, I mean, just sitting, I was kind of assuming my spine was straight rather than, I read on a blog about, said, well, you know what, maybe I'm doing the same, this whole, like, the Burmese position and, like, the pillow, and, because, I don't know. I think that's a very, small instance, I guess, of I don't know, getting stuck. But, I mean, not that it's anything grand, but...
I know what you mean. At Aheji, the first time I went there as a guest at the great monastery, I was sitting in the guest zendo. And they have monks walking behind with a stick, and so it's all very tense and very interesting. And I was sitting absolutely straight. I knew I was. And I was doing my very best to be really good. And a monk came and pushed me. And I had been back like this. He pushed me all the way up here. I couldn't believe it. I didn't feel that. And I think you're right. That's how we are. We have ideas about what we're doing and where we are, and often where it's something else going on entirely.
What stinks is that, I don't know, sometimes another person, there's some things you really can't know without somebody.
Yes, that's right. And that's the trick. That's it. We need each other. We need the formality of the monk pushing us into shape. That's very nice. That was kind of him to do that. And we need our friends and people in the street, whoever is coming along who can set us straight. Also helps to take a vacation every now and then and just pull out of whatever the routine is and do something else. Then when you go back, you see how rigid some of those things are. I think we just have to keep breaking us up over and over again. That's the idea, that we just don't get stuck in one's mode, but just keep falling apart. Shall we read the next one? It's also very, very, very short.
I was going to ask about the about monks and uselessness. There's just like something going between like useless and uselessness.
Well,
what's your question?
Spend time in vain by doing useless things. So that's our koan. What is a worthwhile thing?
But, okay, because I thought that he was saying something about monks and what...
Well, he's talking about monks all the way through here. Students should think of the fact that they will surely die, is how it begins.
Because I thought you said something about monks being useless as well?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, that was around 17. Okay, know that everything outside of the actions of Buddhas and patriarchs is all useless.
Yes. Yeah, that's part of the koan. Who are these?
Maybe not even.
It just seemed like there was. I was thinking there was a dichotomy there between uselessness. Maybe it's a humbling. Anyway,
I want to say spotlighting, not necessarily about what we're talking about. What you guys were sharing about your posture. I mean, I think when I'm going through recently, it's kind of like the opposite. Like, I feel like I'm doing everything wrong, and then I'm like, no, it's okay. I'm doing it.
Yes, yes.
You're getting that it's breaking it up, too.
Yes.
It can be the other way.
Yes.
You know? I mean, all this practice doesn't always be so,
That's a great feeling when that happens. That's wonderful. Yeah. Oh, it's all right. It's really okay. Yeah.
Rationalize. I just see rationalization sometimes, like at least I'm concerned of like deluding myself into thinking everything is okay.
Well, that's the Pollyanna mode. You know, everything is lovely and la-di-da and fine, but that isn't what Ritu is meaning. It's just that Zen is kind of a trick. It sets you up with ritual and form very big time. And in order to fit in as a human being and as a social being, of course, it brings up all our desires to fit in. And so we try real hard to do it right. And it's lovely to do it right. And if everybody's doing it right together, it's a very, very wonderful and empowering feeling. But it can also be a tremendous neurosis to feel all the time that, oh, I'm doing it all wrong, and what is the right way, and I think I'm doing it right, and no, maybe it should be this way, and all, you know, you can go through days of obsessing about whether you're doing it right or not. And then there's that glorious moment when you think, poof, it's okay, it's really all right. It's not so. I remember once in a session, it was very intense, and suddenly I thought that scene in Alice Through the Looking Glass, when she's being abused by the king and the queen, and they're so horrible to her, and she suddenly turns on them and says, "You're nothing but a pack of cards." And I thought, oh, that's right, we're nothing but a pack of cards. Everybody, everything. It was a very freeing moment. But of course, then we slip back into the form again because we are formal creatures as well as free. It's the paradox of our life. We can't live without either one.
Essential for what? Even, like, at least know, I feel comforted. Oh, at least I know that I broke a form.
Yes, that's right. That's helpful. Yeah. Yeah.
You talk about form and maybe extending the word, maybe I heard a little bit more, the formality. And like, if you're in a Zendo and you're kind of following the rules, your capital R, right? Somebody told you that when you get up, you rotate clockwise, not counterclockwise in our tradition. Well, if the rules were to rotate counterclockwise, and when you stood up, you rotated counterclockwise, and in both cases you were aware of the rule, and you know, Suzuki Roshi talked about it, you burn, you leave no trace. You mm-hmm. fully turn right and you fully turn left. Mm-hmm. The fact that it's right or left is
arbitrary. It's totally arbitrary.
It's true, though. I mean, sometimes it's a little bit more dangerous to break the rule or to change the rule. I mean, if we drive on the highway and we hit people, you know, the consequences mm-hmm. in some cases are bigger. But in that particular example, there is practice opportunity in the direction of the turn, mm-hmm. but it's not a biggie. But in both cases, being aware that we signal on the highway and then fill in a blank spot, not one where there's already a car, or we turn right because that's the way, mm-hmm. or the rule, is that in that sense, it can be done fully with awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And there's practice.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
In some cases, on the other side.
That's true. And if you don't know that, you really got to go.
It's completely made up. It's all made up.
Well, the British are backwards.
Yeah. But in Zen, some of the things go back 1,000 years.
Sure.
I think Oryoki must go back that far. And I always imagined that each generation somebody would suggest something, some little change to make it even better, and that what we've inherited is 1,000 years of making it better until it's this sort of polished, magical, amazing little ritual that we do that you can't really justify. It's just made up out of all these minds all through the years.
Sometimes I was telling something that's different that when at the LA Zen Center I did a session with them and the Oryoki was slightly different where you serve yourself and it freaked me out for like a couple of days. It was so hard to do because
yes.
Our trade is so, it's so cherished, we never serve ourselves. We're
yes.
serving each other and so I'm like, maybe I can sit, like, you know, of course it occupied me, like maybe it's like, because what you do, you don't always have to serve yourself because you serve the other person, then you serve yourself. So, like, I figured out a way to sit on the other side because I don't want to serve myself. But then sometimes I got, like, seated on the other side. So it was this big thing. And then by, like, the third day, I'm like, I'm just, like, fighting with myself. It
really doesn't matter.
I'm serving myself. Look, I'm serving myself. Like, I'm right. We're still serving someone.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, like, I think that's what you're talking about, breaking it up. You get so used to how it is. And
yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yes.
It's still Oryoki, and it was still, everything else was the same.
Yes. And you were getting fed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when we had Sesshin, the Doan was the same Doan all during the week. Mm-hmm. And he had decided that he liked to play the bells his own way. And his own way was to have about a 3-minute break between each ring. He would let the ring go until he couldn't hear it anymore, and then he would do the next one. So it took a long time. And so I met with him and said, you know, it's very nice. It's very spacey to get that. You get this feeling of everything opening up in a huge field. But it's also, the bells wake us up. It gets us ready to sit by sort of bracing us and waking us. And I suggested that maybe he could do it the ordinary way. He said, I like it the way I do it. And he just went ahead and did it his own way. Which is a very Jikoji thing to do, I think.
Same reaction as a telemarketer, almost. Yeah. It works.
Yeah.
It will.
Yeah. Yeah. And, of course, that's arbitrary, too. But it gave the whole setup a kind of funny feeling because we usually agree on how we're going to do it, and then we all do it together the same way. And
Duncan did like this little ritual with himself, like by a river. But like whenever he got water
mm-hmm.
from he would always give the half
back
of water back.
Yeah.
No one was looking as far as he could.
The river was.
Yeah.
Yeah, very sweet. Well, the whole question of form is huge. You know, every time teachers get together, that's what they talk about, form, form, form. How do we do this? What's the right way to do it? And ever since I went to Japan and discovered that it's truly arbitrary and nobody knows what the right way is anyway, they're just all making it good for everybody.
We all agree to do it that way.
We do. Yeah.
I signed up for this, and
yeah,
we're going to do it.
Yeah. It was interesting at Sesshin also because Jane was trained in a real form intense Zendo in New Mexico, so she knows everything, how to do everything the right way, and it used to be really wild to do it exactly right, and is no longer quite so obsessed about it. But she loves it and is very good at it. And she had two servers who served with her all week, and they got into it, and they were having a really interesting time learning how to keep focused, keep in samadhi, and do this really strenuous work of carrying food around and serving everybody. And they got so much out of it. And that was a real teaching also, just as much as anything else. We're going to have to put off that teeny one paragraph until next week. Just as well.